So, Brian, why do people actually buy from you?
Rudy, that's a great question. Let me tell you first why they don't, because it goes against, I think, what most people think is the reason. So back like 20-something years ago, I read this book called Selling the Invisible by Harry Beckwith. I think it came out in like 97. So it was one of the earlier business books that I'd ever read. And he has a statement in there that really gets to the heart of the matter. You know, when people think that being the foremost expert means you're entitled to win the business, right? So here's what he said. With most professional services, you're not really selling expertise, because your expertise has to be assumed, because your prospect cannot intelligently evaluate your expertise. So therefore, it stands to reason they're choosing you for something else. But, you know, a lot of experts, consultants, marketers, and entrepreneurs, they don't want to hear this. You know, this is like Al Gore's inconvenient truth, but at the business level, it's not fair, it's not logical, and so they just refuse to adapt to reality. Now, and I got to say, at the time, I was pretty much in this camp, right? So I had left the practice of law, and I had read this book, not in 97, I think it was more like 2001, and this is when I was starting the real estate businesses. So, you know, I was right there with them, believing that the actual superiority of my background, my academic credentials, my experience, my background as a lawyer, that's why I should win in the real estate game. And that's really how I positioned myself. So I basically, you know, it was a very content heavy website, which was a novelty in itself at that time. But I explained how, you know, it was basically the old hook. Here's what the realtors don't want you to know about buying your next home, right? That always works. That was good. That was a copywriter part of me. But I explained, you know, that basically if you go to the listing agent, they work for the seller, you're basically going to get screwed over, and you need not only a buyer agent, but an exclusive buyer agent, someone who will only represent your side of the deal. And then I tied that in to my background as an attorney, because I understood fancy concepts like fiduciary duty and blah, blah, blah. And it really was, although I thought that was an incredibly compelling argument. And the business just took off. So I thought I'd been validated. Screw this Beckwith guy. He doesn't know what he's talking about. But the reality was, when I would talk to clients, either in the initial call or as we worked together, they would say, you know, I almost didn't choose you because I figured you're an attorney and you're going to be boring and awful, right? And I'm like, oh, then why did you choose me? And the other, you know, the main thing was, well, the way you wrote was very human-like, very conversational. And then when I talked to you, you didn't have a stick up your ass. Sorry to use technical terms here, but that is the actual precise terminology for what they were worried I was going to be like. So I was like a normal guy who knew what he was talking about, was clearly positioned to protect their interest in this very large transaction, the biggest transaction most people make. And that was the winning thing. They felt like they understood what I was saying and they believed me, but they also found that I was relatable. And here's the other thing. And I'm like, okay, so why did you even dig in deep enough to find out that I wasn't a guy with a stick up his ass? And they're like, well, you were different. You were saying different things than what realtors usually said, which was normally nothing, or I've won salesperson of the year 15 years in a row, kind of, you know, bragging stuff. And they're like, yeah, when you get someone who just bragging about what a great salesperson they are, you kind of get the feeling they're designed to screw you over. And I'm like, yeah, it's important not to come across as a salesperson, which I didn't consider myself anyway, coming from that background. So as Sally Hogshead says, different is better than better, but different how? I mean, any service, if you're a freelancer, consultant, coach, can be copied. You know, there'll be people lurking on your onboarding, your methodology, everything. and they'll try to replicate it. Besides, people can't tell the difference anyways, and that spills over into products. Everyone thinks, well, my product is better because of this, this, and this feature, but other people are like, I don't see the difference. I'm going with the person that I like. And that sounds very simple, no like and trust, right? But it's a little deeper than that. So effectively, you're the difference. You're the authentic, relatable expert. You are the reason people buy from you in two very important ways. And it's crucial that you incorporate these two things into your messages. Welcome to Seven Figure Small, the podcast that adds to your playbook of strategies and tactics to attract an audience and build your business, all without investors or employees. I'm your host, serial digital entrepreneur Brian Clark. Thanks for joining us. Let's dive in.
So, Brian, it seems that people really still like the seven-figure small brand, and even better, they really identify with the brand Unemployable.
Yeah, I like I said in the email that I just sent out with this episode, that was so much fun. I didn't expect so many people to write in, so my inbox was a disaster, but I read every single one of them, and as I said in the email, it wasn't even close. You know, people really, really like the brand Seven Figure Small. And, you know, it was very interesting to see the perspectives. You know, there were some six-figure people who were like, I'm literally trying to get there, right? And that's why I'm listening to you, because I know you've done it a few times. There were other people who are like, I haven't made it to six figures yet, but it doesn't matter. I know I need to aim high. And if I end up anywhere in six figures, I'm going to be happy. But I, again, feel like it's aspirational to at least structure the business in a way that if things go well and I do what I know I'm capable of, then with an audience-first business, it is possible for me to get to this level. Whether I ever do or whether I ever try to. But the key thing, it's not just seven figures, like go raise money so you can make seven figures and sell your soul to investors. No, it's the small part. It's the no investors, no employees, big profits kind of thing. Another aspect was that to make six figures in income, you have to earn a higher amount of revenue to do that. Now, these are pretty low margin businesses, but if you're using advertising strategies and whatnot, you got to factor in your margins. So yeah, you got to shoot a little higher to get, even if, you know, where you're aiming for is low six figures. So that makes perfect sense to me. But yeah, the unsolicited aspect that was repeated way more times than I would have guessed was people who just segued into, and you know what? I really love Unemployable. And I know why you use two different brands. It makes sense. You know, one's aspirational, one's identity. And that's what these people said. They're like, I identify as Unemployable. And that's why, don't you ever change that part of it. I'm like, oh, we won't. If I mean, the community, the core, the thing that really matters will always be Unemployable. So yeah, it was a wonderful exercise in feedback. A lot of people just said, thank you for asking, which I thought was kind of cool. You know, you usually get questions that are more like, tell me what your number one problem is that you're struggling with. You know, I mean, everyone's kind of seen that kind of stuff and they understand it's for segmentation and product development and all those good things. But I think I got more out of people's answers to this very simple question than perhaps asking one of the more cliched questions. So I was totally digging it. Getting to the point of identity, the other thing that struck me that some of these responses, I think, are from people who are fairly sophisticated at marketing, or they're just repeating something that is so hugely important from their own perspective that, let's connect the dots a little bit here, that identifying with your audience, shared identity, is the game. It really is. You know, at the beginning of Copyblogger, I would have told you it's a whole bunch of content. We know that's not true. Audience is more important than content. If you can get an audience without creating content, you would do it, right? And it's not even really audience when you come down to it. It's your relationship with the audience. It's how well they feel connected to you. You know, so identity is huge, and it's offered, you know, I mean, often glossed over. You know, people are like, create more and better content, improve your product and features, get on Twitter and brag about how you're the best at blah, blah, blah. That's what it sounds like, right? Blah, blah, blah. God, the absolutist statements on Twitter make me want to pull my hair out, but that's a topic for another episode. I've got some interesting stuff on that too. But, you know, I mean, we used to have a program and a conference called Authority. And circling back to where we started, people think, well, as long as I'm the smartest and the bestest expert at this, then I win. But we know that's not true. And even back in those days, we used the term likable expert. You know, we were basically merging two influence components, liking, which is we prefer to do business with people we like, and authority, which is a certain respect and deference to expertise, right? But I think really when it comes to authority, it's unique authority, meaning different authority. People buy from you more for who you are than what you do. And that's why the person who just puts out their dry recitations of expertise, credentials, experience, what have you, who connects with no one ends up poor, despite the fact that they may be the most qualified person in the world at that particular thing. That's not going to get it done. And then after authority, you know, you've got authenticity, right? Probably one of the most misunderstood terms in the world. I still love that Seth Godin said authenticity is determined by the audience, not you. They'll either find you authentic or they don't. But I think it really just boils down to something we already touched on. Don't be a salesperson. Be a real person. You know, have you ever seen how salespeople or listened to how they speak and how it's obviously, you know, they've got their little techniques, like they use your first name repeatedly, which makes me want to punch people. And then, you know, they've got their obvious, you know, closing techniques. You know, I mean, I know them, so it's obvious, but I think it's obvious to most people. I mean, Trudy, what do you think? You know, when someone tries to put the sales moves on you, you see it coming. Yeah.
Mile away. Although, I mean, from a psychological standpoint, someone who uses your name more than once, that's like a positive thing, but I feel
it is. Yeah. Until you know better.
Right. Until you know better. Until you know you're being sold a bag of goods.
Yeah.
And then it's like, forget my name, forget you ever saw my face, and get away from me. And right. That's very true. That's very true.
And I start using their name. No, I use the wrong name back at them repeatedly. And they're like, no, my name is Bob. And I'm like, is it Carl?
You can always tell when people are like jumping into their script. It's like, Brian, that's a great question, Brian. Many people in your neighborhood have asked that question. It's like, okay.
And that's actually a technique. Many people in your neighborhood, that's an affinity technique. It's just poorly done, right? Yes. So our third A here, authority, authenticity, and affinity, how people find you relatable based on what you share in common. Like, young parents with children tend to hang out with other parents with children, right? Because that's a huge affinity that pretty much dominates your life for about 15 years. And so you want to be around with other people that understand what you're going through, play dates, etc. But even within that affinity, it doesn't end there. It tends to break down due to other characteristics, which is, can I stand this person? Am I a soccer mom or a baseball mom? Is surface level, but, you know, other levels of interest and affinity are end up going to divide up that entire group of parents into smaller little cliques or affinity groups, right? And that's how everything works. I mean, it's so obvious in politics right now. that I think some people shake their head and say, look, most of us aren't to the extremes of one side or the other. We're in the middle. And yet I can tell you, we all seek out relationships and buy things based on affinity. And then this next level thing that, that we're going to talk about in a little bit, but start with affinity. Choose your audience by not holding back who you are, but by inserting yourself into your marketing, into your product, into your service, to the point where some people engage with you strongly, other people not so much. Much better than no one engaging with you at all, because you're relying on your naked authority. I think it was Dan Kennedy that once used the term planting affinity seeds. Like, he would give speeches and he would always make sure that he was the last presenter. And this guy is like no nonsense, no BS. This is literally his brand. He's not a terribly nice person, which gives me hope. he's gruff. You know, he's very matter of fact. And some people just love that, you know, but he would mention things here and there about how, you know, he once had to declare bankruptcy, and then, I used to have a drinking problem, not anymore. And just, you know, being human in a way. And he said he would have people come up after his presentation, buying his $300 course that he was selling, but talking about, yeah, I also had to go through bankruptcy, or my brother-in-law had a drinking problem. You know, what can I tell him? You know, I mean, just anything he can do to create affinity with the right kind of people. Now, were there people in the audience who didn't come up after to buy? Of course. The point is, some people came up to buy, and probably in larger numbers than if he had given some dry, you know, by the numbers, I'm an expert, Dan Kennedy type of presentation, right? So yes, it's no like and trust. It works, but it's more sophisticated than that. And I don't think people understand what it actually takes to get to trust. Like, you have to develop trust way before they'll trust you to buy something, but that's a topic for another time.
Right. So, all right, Brian. So I like what you're saying. I like what Kennedy was saying about sort of planting affinity seeds. How does that come off? Like, how does that work in practice? How does it not come off kind of salesy and cheesy?
Yeah, definitely. Again, I guess that goes to the question of authenticity. As soon as you can fake that, you've got it made. But in the meantime, you can just be a real person. You know, we often think of ourselves as content marketers, right? That's the movement that we all kind of came out of. But it's not the content. Like I said, it's more the audience than the content. And it's more your bond, the common bond, the unifying commonality that not only you share with them, but they all kind of share together, right? That's an engaged audience. That's how you make a powerful business without having hundreds of thousands of people. Because you can have 100,000 people on your list, but if only a fraction of that actually really, really is into you, you're not going to sell any more than the person with the 10,000 person list who's got 4,000 or 5,000 people who are really into them. So whenever we talk about minimum viable audience, quit asking how many is that. It's not the total top line number that matters. It's the engaged number. If you need 1,000 true fans, well, you need at least 1,000 of them, but you can do better than that, even with a smaller list. So that's the kind of thing that we're going for. So we're trust-based marketers, I think is a better term. That's what we're really, why we give away all this content, to demonstrate we know what we're talking about, but also to make connection. And of course, as we'll explore, you don't necessarily have to create a lot of content to do that. There are other ways to do it. But effectively, we have to position ourselves as mentors who are going to help people that connect with us in the right way. Because if people don't want to hear from us, they're going to go listen to someone else. So one way to do this is being one of them and demonstrating it, right? I tweeted out something the other day that you'll never change anyone's mind by just kind of berating them. You have to show, I'm like you. I've been where you're at. I can help you because I've changed and therefore so can you. That's the essence of it. Now, that's step one, of course, but I just see so many people pumping out dry, data-laden skyscraper content to rank well in the SERPs, but they're making no human connection whatsoever at all. And I don't care how well you rank in Google when that traffic clicks through. If there's nothing there that says this is my type of person, that's the end of it. And what did you do all that work for, right? So you got to be one of them so that you are more quickly and easily accepted as trustworthy, right? Think of it this way. Not trusting enough to buy from you yet. What if someone doesn't trust enough to open your emails because they're boring or they're dry or they just don't speak to them, right? You've got a big problem right there. The first act of trust is, I trust that this person's not going to waste my time. They're either going to make me laugh. They're going to give me some insight. They're going to make me think differently. If you can't do that, like Seth Godin shows up every day and you know he's going to give you something that's worth your time, right? He's been doing that for 20 years every day. And other people are like, can I mail once a week? I don't know. Can you be awesome once a week? Can you be awesome 5 days a week, right? That's the question, right? Can they trust you to find that message worth opening and reading? Two, making certain to identify every group that your best prospects belong to and gaining access to that. Basically, it's never been easier to lurk on people in social media, joining communities. You know, the Unemployable Initiative is one such community. If you're marketing to people like us who want this very small, powerful business, then you need to understand the type of conversations that are happening in there. And there, and across the board, there's a community, a Facebook group, God forbid, that that speaks to just about any topic, any affinity group that you can imagine. This is basic research 101 audience-wise, with the caveat that don't go trying to learn about a group you have no affinity for. Start with your own affinity, and it's a lot easier to really bond with like-minded people, right? And then finally, you know, this comes down to more your traditional marketing and copy, but giving your prospective clients the opportunity to see that you are trusted and by people like them, right? So it's not just a testimonial. It's a testimonial from someone who fits in the group, the in-group, right? And again, you're going to lose the out-group. That's okay. That's the cost of doing business. The real travesty is when no one cares whatsoever because you've established no affinity with anyone at all. And there's a step beyond this. And I know you two have heard me talk about this a whole bunch, but I'm not sure we've talked about it much on the podcast, and that's unity. So a while back, I mentioned two of the influence factors, liking and authority. We've got things like social proof, commitment and consistency, the six elements that Robert Cialdini established way back in the late 70s or whenever when his book Influence came out. Well, he added a factor and said it was the biggest one of all. And all of us who are in this game are going, that's it. That's what we were trying to get to with the likable expert. Liking is not enough. Authority is not enough. Authenticity is in there, but what does it mean? Well, when you're authentically yourself and you're demonstrating your core values, your affinities, and your general worldview, now people can connect with you and say, oh, not only are you trying to demonstrate that you're one of them, they proactively say, oh, he's one of us. And it impacts everything. Social proof doesn't matter if the wrong people are saying good things about something, right? Authority doesn't matter if you're playing for the wrong team. Again, this is an extreme example, but it happens across the board more subtly than in politics. But Anthony Fauci, right? Half the country thinks this guy's a hero. The other half thinks he's the devil. And it has nothing to do with his credentials. His credentials have got to be top of the line, right? To be in the position he's in. Meanwhile, if you're in the other tribe, some hack who's got no credentials is regarded as an authority by people who want to believe what that person is saying, right? So this goes back full circle. You may be the most qualified person in the world on immunology, but if you're not part of that team, not only do they not believe you, they don't like you. Now, again, extreme example, but it's more subtle and pervasive than that across the board. You know, anytime whether you feel like you hit it off with someone or not, right? It's very basic. And yet, why so often are we afraid to be ourselves, to tell stories, to make the metaphors and pop culture references and all of that? I mean, you know, when I started Copy Blogger, I was authentically me by making Depeche Mode, you know, metaphors and the Prince Guide to Online Marketing. You know, that was just me. I wasn't being, that was like a soft strategy. I'm like, well, this is funny and interesting. I just want people to like the content, so I'm going to make it entertaining. Now I realize that was a hard strategy. That was, you know, those some of those Gen Xers have been with me from day one.
I'm one of them. Still,
Trudy is one of them.
I remember the Prince Guide. I do.
Yeah.
So right. There you have it.
So yeah, so beyond just I am into this or I like that or making this pop culture reference or whatnot, go deeper, you know, core values. I bet you if I asked you what does Apple stand for, at least before Steve Jobs died, you could probably tell me. And if I ask you what Harley Davidson stands for, it's a very different set of core values, but you could probably tell me. Those are $2 billion dollar companies that have effectively used not only affinity, which is motorcycle riding and computing, but core values, creativity, fighting against the status quo, rebellion, freedom, right? These are the kind of core values that I'm talking about. Even Copyblogger did that, right? So I'm not going to necessarily say that that Copyblogger was on the level of Apple or Harley Davidson, but what we're talking about here is scale, the techniques of unity, unification amongst you and your best prospect should be an intentional, strategic yet authentic thing. Is that possible to be strategic and authentic? Of course it is. You're doing it for a good reason, but it's still you. All I would say is be the best version of you for that audience, because again, they'll be the ones determining whether they find you authentic or not. So we'll be talking about this in future weeks, but for now, here's the main takeaway. You can churn out all the content possible, but if you don't connect with your audience at the affinity and unity level, they're likely going to buy from someone else. Even if your product or service is quote unquote better in some objective sense, that does not exist because everything's subjective in the mind and the affinity of the prospect. So there you have it. Jared and Trudy, what else would we like to talk about on this fine afternoon?
Well, Brian, since this is the first podcast episode that we have published in a while, I do want to just let people know that if you see anything funny happening with the feed of old episodes, please let me know, because we are having to migrate episodes to a new feed. Because this has been the month, or I guess 2 months, of anything that can go wrong with technology and data and storage will go wrong. And so we actually had our original podcast feed deleted, unbeknownst to us, by our previous host. And so I'm having to migrate those episodes over. So if you notice anything a little funky, if you go into the archives, just let me know. But I'm working through that to get all those old episodes back up. So
as usual, know,
which is only the tip of the iceberg of the technical challenges.
As usual, Jared is way too diplomatic about this whole fiasco.
Yeah.
I'd say the whole first 6 months of 2022 were just insane in different ways. But yeah, before we even find, I remember the day you called me, Jared, to tell me, you're like, are you ready to hear this? And I'm like, I don't see how anything could get any worse than losing
the
Further,
the timing was so
which
bad.
Is like a 6 or 7 year old site. right? And then Future Freedom was started a year ago in May, so exactly on its anniversary, pretty much, a whole year of a membership site. Not a lot of outside content. It was a product. I built that thing for a year, every single week, often multiple lessons and content. And long story short, if you haven't heard the story, both Further and Future Freedom just disappeared one day. They were offline. I'm like, okay, well, this sucks, but they'll be back in a day or later today. Or, okay, 2 days later. Okay, a week later, for sure. Like, I didn't even say anything for the first week because I'm just in a state of denial, disbelief. But what were they gone for? 6 weeks?
Thereabouts, yeah. Sounds about right.
So here's what happened. Apparently, this is what I hear. There is litigation ensuing, as you can bet and imagine. But they were able to retrieve the sites. But what happened was there was an attack against a website that was hosted in the same data center that our hosting company uses, right? So a host, people don't realize that hosts don't like host on computers. You know, I think people do now with Amazon Web Services and whatnot. But, you know, think about WP Engine. When they bought StudioPress, they did $131 million that year in revenue, and they don't have their own data center, right? They use cloud, right? Okay. So this is how the industry works. So our hosting provider did nothing wrong. This was an attack against someone who wasn't even hosted with our hosting provider, happened to be in the same data center. Okay, you're saying right now at home, Brian, there should be backups, right? That's right. Enterprise best practices backups held in a separate data center, geographically separate. The hackers took that down too. Then they took down a third data center just to be sure. So to get this one site and its backups, they took down three data centers, thousands of other sites. They didn't access the information. That would be like a hack. This is ransomware. They encrypted everything so no one could get to it unless you pay the ransom. And from what we heard, this whoever the target was, they were not paying this ransom. We're like, oh my God, they're gone. Our sites are really gone. Like after the first week, I started waking up in the middle of the night going, they're gone. Oh God. Then I'd go, no, they're not. No, they're not. And I'd go back to sleep. But yeah. And then so we recreated Further from old ConvertKit newsletter archives. Like we had years of issues in there, right? The valuable thing for Further is the email list, right? Always back up your email list. God, if ConvertKit went down, the wailing that would ensue among the creator community would be deafening. So download and back up your email list and your website locally. But Future Freedom, I went back to Google Docs. I had saved, thankfully, all but one lesson. And why? What was I thinking deleting that Google Doc? I don't know. I have an issue with digital clutter. Like, I love to delete stuff. And Trudy's like, I don't delete anything ever. And I'm like, yeah, that's I'm like my wife.
I'm a digital hoarder. And I feel like that pays off. It does. Yeah,
it does. It does. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I reassembled Future Freedom, got it all to the point where our members were so cool. No one asked for a refund. Renewals went through while the site was down. I just can't believe how cool everyone was. So I reassembled everything over at Unemployable. We got people pointed over in that direction. And then the site came back.
Yeah.
And, which you're like, well, you don't sound excited. And I'm like, could you not have come back like, 10 days earlier. But the amount of work of cleanup we had to do once the site came back, reconciling everyone who had renewed in Stripe or PayPal while the site was offline, they couldn't talk to each other. So it became a giant data entry project for me on this beautiful weekend that I had a while back.
But isn't it interesting how this story plays into what you just talked about? It's like, The content is just the content. What matters is the relationship with the audience. So the content went down, but we had the email list. So we had the relationship with the audience. You know, the podcast episodes went down, but we were able to change our feed URL and keep the subscribers, like the relationship, the place for people listening.
Oh, yeah. I'd be really upset if we would have lost an email list or the podcast subscribers. So that takes us to the next level when Jared calls me up. I'm working in a coffee shop and he's like, "Are you sitting down?" And I'm like, "Well, they frown on you if you stand and work here." He goes, "Well, I don't even know how you told me. Like, how did you?"
I was so nervous. I was like planning what I was going to say. And so I think I just ripped the Band-Aid off. I was like, "You're not going to believe
it." I think
this.
You did. Like, we lost our entire podcast. And I'm like,
"Yeah.
What? Don't we pay Spreaker for this? How did this happen?" And they still can't explain to us how they deleted our account, but they did. Now, this is a good, you know, we do have all those audio files. But with everything that with Further coming back and having to redo what we had redone, and then Future Freedom coming back and having to redo what we redone, we're just now getting all those episodes back. I had a guy who forwarded an issue of Further to me, and he's like, "Your podcast is gone." And I'm like, "Wait a minute, we're cross-pollinating here." I'm like, yeah, we're fixing that. Yeah. We're getting on that. But what matters now is we're back with new material and a new, more reliable. Should we give a shout out to our podcast company, or do we not want to? Do we not want to advocate for anyone at this point?
Transistor, I love Transistor. I've had a great experience with them. That's Justin Jackson. I forget the other person who does it with him.
Justin Jackson? I didn't know that.
Yes. Yeah, I think they do a great
job. Well, we've had a lot of good luck with them. We use some of their private feed things for members and stuff like that. So, yeah, I've been really happy with them. So, don't use Spreaker.
Nope.
That's just my personal experience. That's just my personal experience. You know, you make your own decisions. But yeah, it's, I think we're going to have a much better second half of the year. I mean, it can't get worse. Well,
my God.
Don't tempt this world.
Look, this is a wooden desk. I got
it. Knock all the wood.
All the wood. We're not superstitious. Trudy, what's up over there? What are you thinking? Give us some parting thoughts from the freelance extraordinaire.
Well, thank you. I love being framed that way. But, you know, honestly, just listening to what we were just talking about and what we were just sharing about the foibles, and that's a nice way of putting that, of losing sites and things going down and losing podcasts, you know, that affinity piece of it. I love it because I feel like there are a lot of people that feel like I can't be transparent. I can't talk about what went on. We have to be professional. We have to look a certain way. And honestly, to me, this is all learning. Like, I feel like we could do a whole separate show about what does it mean to back up locally? What do you need to do to protect your hard work, your business? So I just lived through it with y'all. It was Mercury retrograde. I'm just bringing in a little LA moment. That's when it all went down, people. Just being honest. But the rest of it, I feel like, you know, if you want to run a seven-figure small business, Brian, you just shared rolling up your shirt sleeves, spending weekends rebuilding because you care, right? Because it's a community we care about that we built, you know, that you built, and now I'm riding on your coattails. Thanks very much. And I don't know. I think there's a lot of actually just meta learning just in that. And, you know, and also hearing how supportive and lovely, like you were saying, people were sending old issues of Further and all that. It's pretty awesome. So
yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way. I was just like, wait till you hear this story. This is
right.
Don't let this happen to you. Jared, what about you? What do you got?
I echo a lot of what Trudy said. You know, I think situations like this, when they happen, you know, there's two ways that you can do it. You can kind of try to, you know, make sure no one gets a peek behind the curtain, or, you know, in our business where, you know, we're kind of trying to, you know, we're trying to walk a path that other people are trying to walk. And so I think showing that, using it as a learning experience and showing that, you know, hey, we may be a little bit out in front, but these things still happen to us. I think it does help with that affinity and that connection and that unity. It's like we're all in this together. We may be at a little bit different stages, you know, but we're all essentially here together and kind of helping each other out. And honestly, like, you know, in my experience now building online communities, that's what people want. They just want a place where they feel seen, they feel heard, and they're going through some stuff at the same time with, you know, with people that they like, you know? And so if you can do that and give that to people, you give someone that you give them something that they really value.
Amen to that. Nice. Nice thoughts from both of you. I think I'll leave it at that and just let you know we're back, baby. And we'll be back with another episode for you before you know it. Hopefully sparking insight, affinity, unity, and yeah. That was not a prepared close, as one could tell. So all right, everyone, take care. We'll talk soon.
Bye.
We just laid out on you there so you could come back and finish it up.
Yeah. We need some outtakes.
Uh-huh. I like me watching your cat the entire episode.
Yeah.
Like your cat, was doing all sorts of like crazy calisthenics.
Yep. At least he's quiet. Psyched. I didn't even notice him.
He's psyched to be back. So yeah, Brian, send me over.